From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners, great people. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, no matter how many political religious right apologists contort themselves to give cover for the mendacity of this administration, lies continue to be lies. It's too early to tell what the eventual fallout of the shocking and tape-recorded revelations in Watergate reporter Bob Woodward's new book will be, but one thing is true. Lies cost lives. And the motivation behind those lies is secondary to the reality. We have endured years of alternative facts, and so many of those who claim the mantle of ethical and spiritual leaders have looked the other way for financial and political expediency. Perhaps this is not yet the moment that the truth reclaims the higher moral ground. But my friends, that day is surely coming, as it has so many times throughout human history. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
Good evening. Today, our fellow citizens, our way of life, our very freedom came under attack in a series of deliberate and deadly terrorist acts. The victims were in airplanes or in their offices, secretaries, businessmen and women, military and federal workers, moms and dads, friends and neighbors. Thousands of lives were suddenly ended by evil, despicable acts of terror.
Incredibly, Friday marked the 19th anniversary of the deadliest terrorist attack in our nation's history. But it's what we did in the aftermath of 9/11, what was done in our name, that has had the most impact on America and on the world. Wars were launched, lies were told, and entire ancient cultures and religions were denigrated and demonized. Bravely standing up in the face of the immediate and ongoing response has been a growing group of survivors of those airborne attacks organized as September 11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. It's become our annual tradition to feature one voice of the many belonging to the membership, and this year is no exception. Later in the show, you'll meet Layla Murphy, who lost her father in the Twin Towers on that terrible, terrible day.
President Trump summed it up in a tweet. Our great country has been divided for decades. Sometimes you need protest in order to heal, and we will heal and be stronger than ever before. Those words came Saturday, the same day an estimated 40,000 counter-protesters marched through Boston in response to a right-wing free speech rally. It was a week after deadly clashes erupted at a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Staying with the theme of conflict and resolution, we'll examine an important new book that appeared earlier this year with the title, I Am Not Your Enemy, Stories to Transform a Divided World. Welton will be talking with the author, Michael McRae.
These movements often act in response to who it looks like is going to win. So if it looks like folks from the left are going to get elected, the hard, violent right will often respond beforehand or with a rising tide that starts beforehand.
More and more experts are starting to say what we've been worrying about privately for months. No matter the outcome of the November 3rd vote, our nation is in for a very difficult time indeed. If we see the result relentlessly questioned and public confidence undermined, well, that's already happened in 2016. If we see outright violence in our streets, well, that won't be much news either. But for this to happen in connection with an American election, a model for the world for centuries, is not only heartbreaking, it is also terrifying. That's why here at State of Belief, we're embarking on a series of interviews with leaders, both religious and secular, who are preparing for the worst and taking seriously the responsibility to lead and intercede no matter how great the crisis. We'll also be talking to experts on conflict resolution, both home and abroad, people who have seen some of the greatest impasses begin to dissolve as we search for some hope in the face of overwhelming challenges. The title that came to mind for this series is Healing the Nation, shamelessly borrowed from the inspiring organization headed by my longtime friend, the Reverend Dr. Jim Forbes, Jr., the Healing of the Nation's Foundation. And so, it's only fair that we start with Dr. Forbes himself. Jim, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
My pleasure to be with you again.
You have done such inspiring work in conflict areas around the world. Did you ever imagine we would be worrying about Americans rejecting the result of a Democratic vote and possibly even resorting to violence?
I am shocked that that's an issue before us. I think it's wonderful that we grew up in a land where we at least thought that the institutions of government and the procedures with respect to how elections would take place, we could take that for granted as at least one stabilizing element. But now we have come to the place where there is the shaking of the foundation. Mm-hmm. And it feels like if you've never been in an earthquake, well, yeah. Let's say we've all been in one. We are in one now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jim, what are the most important lessons that you've learned in doing this work with the foundation? What works in the pursuit of healing?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm an expert on these matters. What I have finally come to is, as they say, if you are trying to heal, it makes sense to know what's wrong with you. In fact, I think I remember a time when you saw a guy and his nose was running. You didn't know what medicine to get unless you know, why is his nose running? Is it running because he's happy and he's crying and tears are accompanying his joy? Or is it sadness so profound that he cannot contain the tears? Or is it because of an infection and that somehow, whether is it diphtheria? Or has he been on drugs so far? Isn't that interesting? Hmm. Do we know why we are so at each other's necks today? If we got some clarity about that, that might help.
Are people reticent or maybe even scared to ask what's wrong?
I think many of us are afraid to reach out for therapeutic possibilities unless we have renewed assurance that there is remediation that is available and likely to bring result. Some people would rather wade through the imponderables of our present crisis than to even reach out, because who knows, if you don't have any, if somebody says, I'm not even going in for a test because I'd rather not know whether I have disease unless I know there's something that can heal it.
Yeah.
And that's what I think is I think most people, I think people say, you know, if you know you got something that can handle what's wrong with me, I may present myself for the analysis.
Jim, what keeps me up at night is knowing that there are many Americans who are not feeling motivated to start the work of reconciliation. They see their quote-unquote side as winning and the other side as a dangerous enemy. In light of that, do you think it's possible to help those who see no need for a coming together at all to rethink that position? And if so, what would that help look like?
Well, as I remember Jesus saying, they that are whole have no need of a physician, which meant those who think they are whole have no need of a physician. That means that if we are in a, if we talk about the state of belief, if we are in a state of denial about the malaise that's covering the land, we are not likely to reach out. However, I think there is a growing sense that whether we didn't want to deny it or not, something is wrong. And the question is, I think people are in a research mode. Somebody has told us that told various people we can be greater than we are. And they enrolled in the project. And they are waiting to see, will the proposed plan bring us the healing that we want? So I think many people are holding on, even though it looks very bleak, saying, well, we're in the midst of an experiment to see whether the spirit from the national level is going to lead us where we ought to go. Have we really defeated the enemy? Was it the true enemy? All of that stuff. So let me get right to the heart of what I think. That is to say, somebody has taught people that there is a group of people who are adversarial to your well-being. And some folks have bought into that. Whether or not it's the media, whether or not it's liberals, whether or not it's black people, whether or not it's Latin people in this country or on the south of the border, a whole lot of people think they have identified who is the adversary to their good wishes and good pleasures. And when somebody has demonized a group of people and you have bought into it, you're eager to see if somebody can embarrass, threaten, and even possibly destroy our adversaries, that's our champion. I'm a Pentecostal by background. Am I speaking in tongues? Why don't I just come on out and say that the current national leadership seems to have unleashed the spirit of revenge against other people other than those who feel they're despised and rejected by other people. And now that they think they've got an enemy and they have a champion who is able to help them fight that enemy, defeat that enemy, polarization is a part of a plan. Polarization looks like the good fight. We have, so there are people who are absolutely convinced that the future well-being of some people will come as they overthrow the very existence of others. That's a bad lesson, but it is a lesson that is being taught and also being accepted by large swaths of American citizenship.
Mm. Jim, you know State of Belief, you know Interfaith Alliance, always we've tried to respect the right of every religion to set its own dogmas and teachings, no matter how much we may disagree with them. But now we see things like this Catholic priest in Wisconsin using his position to fan the flames of division and disrespect. Is there a line past which, if we don't see self-policing in the given church, we all need to speak out?
Yes, we do need to speak out. And I would like to put it like this. Suppose we reached a point that when we know that we are offending against the compassionate heart of God. Remember, when Jesus says, if you offend one of these my little ones, it would be better for you to be in the midst of an ocean with a millstone around your neck. What happens when it is, as the psalmist says, it's against thee and thee only have I sinned and done this evil? And I say, when we look and see people who have chosen the path of bigotry, the path of antipathy towards people of different races or ethnicities or even religious positions, when that becomes the policy, it becomes, in a sense, a fight against God, a fight against the principles that we at least thought we discerned from God. So when the battle is not just white folks against black folks or liberals against conservatives, but God's children fighting against each other. The way I look at it now, I want to listen to the voice of Mama Eternal, who sees her children at each other's necks. And I hear, like I used to hear my mother say, we had 8 kids, we'd be fussing and fighting. She said, you kids run me crazy. Can't you kids behave? Don't you know you're one family? Stop it. Is it possible that we can hear, amidst all of the struggles going on across this country, can we hear Mama Eternal saying, stop it, you kids, destroying one another? You are a disgrace to your heavenly parent. You're all my children. So I guess I'm working my way around to say the analysis right now that I hold dear is that we are living in an age of despiritualization. That's my constant mantra. When a society loses its source of values, meaning, purpose, responsibility, accountability, environmental hospitality, and foundational aspects of personal, emotional, natural and divine relationality, that's despiritualization. We as a culture have pushed aside the spirit that we consider to be associated with our very creation. And with the distancing of our consciousness from a sense of God, from a sense of the spirit, we have lost the basis for community. Therefore, we are in the throes of fragmentation and alienation, one from the other. And I feel that nothing short of finding our way back to the foundational reality of the God of creation who made us will see us through the struggles we are passing through now.
Mm. Jim, we are worried about what is likely to happen after the 2020 election, regardless of the actual outcome. The potential violence we fear, as well as the actual violence that we've been seeing in a few of our cities, very real. But it strikes me that particularly for African Americans, violence is a daily threat, and it's a powerful influence on how one leads one's life. So would you talk about that, about how the threat of violence looks very different to people already vulnerable to violence from those in positions of power and authority?
My fascinating recollection is to 1962. That's a long time ago. I was in a course taught by George D. Kelsey. He was using for his lectures the galleys from his book, Racism and the Christian Understanding of Man. He said something that shocked me in that classroom and has been with me ever since, and now looms large in my consciousness with all of the police brutality that we are observing. He said, the logic of racism is genocide. He says, why? Because in the case of racism, full-grown racism understands that what's wrong with black people is their being, their existence. They are a diminutive form of human existence. They are flawed creatures, and they introduce a toxic dynamic into any community they're in just by their being. Not whether they're good folks or bad folks, just being black is adversarial to the well-being of creation itself. That man, I was sitting up in the class, so he says, although there are many people who would never think of killing anybody, racism itself, because it has acknowledged that black people are not of the same species, they are not positive contributors to the well-being of civilization. So suppressing them, subjugating them, diminishing them is a part of the larger plan. Get rid of them. Can you imagine what I felt like in a class ever since that time? Whenever I look at a situation, I say that not everybody has been hung from a tree or hanged from a tree. Not everybody is being shot, but that all of us are in at least a preliminary mode of extinction. And COVID-19 reveals the degree to which you don't have to just kill them off, diminish their immunity, their immune system, diminish their health, diminish their sense of well-being, diminish their sense of self-worth, diminish their sense of respect for each other, diminish. Gosh. Well, then, black people don't have to wait till the election for the violence to break out. In fact, there are some who wonder, at least we will have a more realistic response to what our condition has been all along. Vulnerable to genocidal impulses. And that's what segregation does. That's what not having health care does. That's what not having decent jobs, decent wages, education for our children. All those factors are at work every day before you get up. You don't have to have a mean-spirited, bigoted white person do something unusual. The system itself is doing it. And when we raise the question about genocide, a lot of people say, well, I'd never participate in that. One does not have to. The system has arranged. When black people escaped from slavery, police were instituted to go and get them. Fugitive slave acts were saying, if they think they're going to break free, let's get law enforcement officers that trace them as far north as Canada, and you find them and bring them back into the bondage of death. Mm. Now, what I'm really saying to you, my brother, until those who are of a positive humanizing spirit recognize that the mechanisms of genocide are at work in the system of Jim Crow that we have put into order here. Mm. Until that is dealt with, we are all a part of a system, a part of whose agenda and plan is the extermination of those who are the out race. And so you talk about, people, what's going to happen after the election? Well, my answer is, it's amazing how skillful this system has been. When you get rid of slavery, you find other ways to sustain the genocidal process. Some hopefully find a more, shall I say, a less brutal and barbaric way to go about it. Subtlety, there are many people who would say, oh, no, I would never. I'd never support a plan of exterminating people. I wouldn't have supported Hitler if I had been there. And I'm trying to say to America, you don't have to be a Hitler. You don't have to be a lyncher. All you have to do is to allow racism to continue to be the official philosophy that shapes our society. It will happen because way will always be found to serve the god of racism, and he will exact the sacrifice of these demonic people who are not truly human, but subhuman. Anyway, until we solve that problem, until we decide that racism is a big lie out of the pit of hell, and that we decent people disavow it, and we are preparing now to change it, to get rid of it, to start a new life in America, that we plead humbly with God, forgive us for the barbarity of our ways. Forgive us for accepting the benefits which come from this system when it is also, we receive our benefits from a system that is dedicated to the perpetual extermination of some of God's children. And we love these benefits. I mean, who wouldn't love the power, the money, the housing, the neighborhoods, the jobs that white people systematically have, passing it down? Who wouldn't love to be debt-free. Who wouldn't love to have health care arrangements? Everybody likes those benefits. But when people finally discover that they enjoy them in exchange for the extermination of God's children day by day, I think that when most people finally see that, they will probably wish to say, Lord, can't you bless me in some other way that does not have a murderous intent associated with the productivity out of which I enjoy the benefits of my life? Now listen, Welton, you don't usually listen that long without having to ask a question. So I better stop and let you ask me a question. This is an interview time, not a
Well, listen, when I listen to you, you go to my head and you go to my heart. The Reverend Dr. James A. Forbes is Senior Minister Emeritus of the Riverside Church in New York City. He is president and founder of the Healing of the Nations Foundation, a national nonprofit faith-based corporation that creates transformative dialogues and events to heal the wounds of racial, religious, and economic injustice festering in our nation. Jim, I know you didn't have time to do this, but you did, and you've always been so kind. My friendship with you is cherished, and I thank you for taking the time to be with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for giving me a chance to save us in my heart.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, Michael McRae, and later, marking the 19th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks with September 11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy.
This week, Welton spoke with Michael McRae, author of the recent book, I Am Not Your Enemy, Stories to Transform a Divided World.
Alienation, division, anger, hatred. These are terms ever more frequently applied to our nation today. And as we fearfully look at what the next manifestations of these intense emotions might be in our land, it is essential that we give up the notion that we are unique in being confronted with them, indeed, that we give up even the notion that we are unique in confronting them in what is, by any standard, an age of peace and prosperity. Michael, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. I'm really delighted to be here. I appreciate you having me on.
How long have you been engaged in the work of conflict resolution?
Well, I got my master's in conflict resolution in 2012, living in Belfast in Northern Ireland, and then have been traveling in the Middle East since I was 10. So in some ways have been around these issues for a while, but professionally I've been thinking about it for about 8 or 9 years.
Hmm. In the book, you present moving stories of people who rose above incredible suffering to see the humanity in each other. Could you start with just telling us one favorite example?
Yeah. So one of the stories that stuck out to me, it's one that I based the title of the book on, which is called I Am Not Your Enemy. And the chapter title is called I've Just Met the Enemy. It's the story of Jo Barry, who's an English woman whose father was murdered by an IRA bomber. Her father was a member of the British Parliament. IRA was an Irish paramilitary group fighting against the British, and her dad was killed in a bomb. And for years, Joe struggled with what to do with that, as anyone would. But in 2000, when the Good Friday Accords had been signed and a lot of the political prisoners were released, she had the chance to actually meet Patrick McGee, the man that planted the bomb that killed her father. And they were able to meet in a room, have a conversation that started out kind of poorly, where Patrick was justifying a lot of what he had done, a lot of the violence that he had committed, and kind of political justifications, and Joe was just getting tired of hearing it. And so she was about to leave the room when Patrick then said, "You know what, I don't actually know what to say anymore. I think what I need to do is to hear your rage and to know where what you feel, how you see this." And it changed the whole course of their conversation. Mm-hmm. And they ended up meeting many times after that and building what Joe would call a real friendship, where she was able to say, "I obviously don't agree with Patrick's decision, political decision to kill my father. Mm-hmm. But I can imagine, had I grown up where he grew up in Northern Ireland with his stories and his pain, his experiences, that I might have been driven to do the same thing." And so they now spend a lot of their professional life traveling the world together, speaking on forgiveness and reconciliation. And so it was an actual case of somebody who met their enemy, an actual real world enemy, they exist, and was able to find a way not just to sit in the same room, but actually to create some kind of friendship with them because of the practice of empathy.
Yeah. Good grief. That is so inspiring and insightful. Will you tell us another story?
So, yeah, there was another case of two men. It's where the book ends, Rami El-Hanan and Bassam Aramin. Rami is an Israeli father whose father survived Auschwitz, but whose daughter didn't survive her 14th birthday. Her name was Smadar, and she was killed in Jerusalem by a Palestinian suicide bomber. And then Bassam Aramin is a Palestinian father whose daughter, Abir, was 10 years old when she was shot in the back of the head by an Israeli soldier on her way home from school and killed. And they both experienced the power of grief as a nuclear energy that could lead them in one of two directions, one being the perpetuation of grief on other people. There's a phrase that trauma that is not transformed is transferred, that it is an energy, and that when we do not find a way to turn it into something that can help us, we will only continue to perpetuate harm. And this is the decision that they were faced with. What do we do with this catastrophic grief that we feel? And so what they decided they had to do was to do everything within their power to make sure that other people did not experience the same pain that they did. That instead that they say, you know, look, we've paid the highest price possible. We're the ones, if anyone has a right to keep this conflict going, it's us. We're the ones that have lost our children. But it's precisely because of this shared pain that we have a shared responsibility now to work toward a peaceful resolution to this conflict and some kind of equity and justice. Mm-hmm. And so they joined an organization called the Parent Circle, which is Israeli and Palestinian bereaved family members who were using the shared bitterness of their tears, the shared sense of loss and grief as a sense of common ground for working towards some kind of shared country.
Mm-hmm. Michael, as you look at the stories that you share in the book, are there common themes that emerge? And by that I mean themes that either seem most dangerous in the escalation of conflict, as well as themes to what finally breaks that cycle across different cultures and communities?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think some of the commonalities in terms of what perpetuate conflict are unaddressed grievances. You know, people have legitimate grievances, fear, you know, historical wounds. There was often a sense to which a lot of these historical grievances are kept alive through the myths and the stories that are told about the other, that we don't have what we need or we are under attack because of them. And so there's a really clear target for animosity. And that there was this sense of dehumanization, that it is in the interest of the perpetuation of conflict to make the other as simple and as uninteresting and as unnuanced as possible. Because humans are complex. And so when you can make someone not complex and just say, well, they are, you know, terrorists, they are occupiers, they are just police, they are X, Y, and Z, it becomes much easier to kind of narrow in your firepower.
Yeah.
So I saw those a lot. Basically, the power of stories, which is my focus. I work in storytelling and peace building, so the power of stories to perpetuate that. But then I also saw the power of stories to heal, that what was transformative in almost all the stories that I encountered was when somebody who had othered this group who had an enemy in their mind, it was almost always in their imagination, you know, that they imagined a story about this person. They were writing this narrative about their enemy in their own mind. And what changed for them was when they actually met the person, when they met the other, when they sat down, when they were actually able to hear the stories, which doesn't always solve it. But I've often said that in my mind, the way we dismantle enemies is three ways. One, we get proximate. We actually have to get closer to the thing that we're afraid of, that we hate. We have to be humble. We have to actually wonder in our minds, has it occurred to us that we might have been wrong about the other? And then that has to lead us into curiosity. We must actually want to know something beyond what we have felt like we know. And that those three things, proximity, humility, and curiosity, showed up in all the stories of transformation that I encountered on my travels.
Hmm. If you could get leaders both here and abroad to sit and listen to you right now, leaders who are using provocative tactics that divide and disturb, that inflame fear and anger, leaders both secular and religious, Michael, what would you say to them as a warning?
I would say that I don't actually know what I would say. My gut at the moment is saying, I would want to say as a warning, we are headed toward the death of many people that we care about, that we're responsible for, that we love. I think we're on the verge of armed conflict in the United States. And I think a lot of people are going to die. And I would want that to be a warning. And then as an encouragement to say, despite the clear differences that we have, there is, I think, a sense of shared need. You know, in conflict resolution theory, there's something called the Penn diagram, which is basically a pyramid. And at the top, the smallest piece of the pyramid is called positions. The middle portion is called interests. And the largest portion at the very bottom of the pyramid is needs. And the idea is that when we get into conflict, usually what we do is we argue our positions. Well, we need to defund the police, or no, police need to be everywhere, or we need to be here, or no, we need to be there. Whatever it might be, we argue positions. And that's the smallest piece of what we have in common. But that, in fact, when we can get down to the level of needs, there's a lot more opportunity for connection. And so even here in the United States, I think we have this sense to which a shared need is the need to, like, the need to protect what we have, the need to protect our sense of self, our belonging, and our security. Because I think on all sides of this, there is a fear that what we have, what we cherish, what we love is going to be taken from us, whether that's a black family afraid of a police officer who might kill their child, or whether it's a white person being afraid that their way of life or their sense of identity is under attack and it's all going to be taken from them. The need is, in fact, the same, though it's manifesting in very radically different positions.
Does that mean that you see in the current crisis in our nation a sign, a hopeful sign, or did I just misunderstand that, or are we really at a moment carooning toward a cliff that we can't stop?
There's a sense to which I think, I mean, I guess I nuance it slightly. My analysis of what's happening in the United States is that I think we are primed for armed conflict. I don't think we're unique in the world, as you were saying at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I've spent time in Rwanda, South Africa, Israel, Palestine, Northern Ireland, and places where people thought it won't happen here, it happens there. And I think it can happen here. It's not to say that I think it's going to, but I think we're primed for it. So there is a sense to which I do feel fear about what's coming and the amount of weapons that are there, the amount of polarizations that that exist. And at the same time, I think part of the hope for me lies in the fact that I don't know that there's ever been as many people mobilized in service of a movement for social justice and equality than right now in the United States. I think within our country, at least, that there is something hopeful about the diversity of people marching, the diversity of people taking to the streets. You know, the fact that the National Basketball Association, the NBA, has Black Lives Matter and is kneeling and all these things that are just very public that are new in a sense. And I think that is encouraging to me. And that's sitting side by side with the reality that we may still have armed conflict.
I wish before we go that you would tell our listeners what you really want them to know and understand about the stories that you're telling in this book?
I think what I took away from the stories that I gathered in I Am Not Your Enemy is that enemies are real. That terrible pain can find us at any time, that none of us are fully safe from the difficulties of conflict and violence. And yet, even in the worst experiences of our lives, the worst moments, there are ways out of violence. There is the possibility of cultivating an imagination that sees the world beyond the idea of enemies, that trauma can actually be transformed. It doesn't have to be transferred. And that through the power of empathy, of trying to imagine the narrative and life of another, the practice of getting proximate, the practice of being humble, that we actually can find a way to live together without violence.
Hmm. One other question. Would you talk for just a minute about the study guide that is available in conjunction with this book, and how is that intended to be used and by whom?
Yeah, so I wrote a discussion guide to I Am Not Your Enemy, which is available through my website. You can go to michaelmcrae.com and subscribe to the website, and you'll be sent the discussion guide. And it's meant to be used really by anyone. You can use it as a way to do self-reflection, read through the book, answer questions from each chapter. It was kind of designed really for small groups, I guess, whether that's a small group of people that you go to work with, that you worship with, or just a group of friends that you get together. But it's intended to spark discussion that has no right or wrong answer to it, really open-ended discussion around what do we do with these themes? How do we make sense of the purpose of dialogue? How do we deal with trauma? And to focus on where does it show up in your community? Because I told stories from abroad, but the purpose was to help us see with a new focus the problems and possibilities in our own small corners of the world. And so I think it does us very little good to simply say, well, what does this mean in Israel and Palestine? The question for me, living in Nashville, Tennessee, is what does Israel-Palestine teach me about how I should show up in Nashville, Tennessee? And so that's what I hope people will do with the study guide.
Michael McRae is an author, facilitator, story practitioner, conflict mediator, and educator. Michael, thank you so much for writing the book, and thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Happy to be here. Really grateful for the invitation.
Michael McRae is the author of the important book, I Am Not Your Enemy, Stories to Transform a Divided World.
Every year on the anniversary of the tragic attacks of 9/11, we feature the heroic work of September 11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. And this year is no exception. On the 19th anniversary of these deadly attacks, I'm very grateful to welcome Layla Murphy to State of Belief Radio. Layla, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Would you start by talking briefly about the incredibly painful loss that you personally experienced on 9/11?
Yes. So my father, Brian Murphy, worked for Cantor Fitzgerald, and he was killed in the attacks. He was working there on the day and was killed in the attacks, and I was 3 years old at the time.
Hmm. So many people reacted to the attacks with thoughts only of revenge and retribution. This is a profoundly human response. What drew you to the radically different response championed by September 11 Families of Peaceful Tomorrows?
Yeah, so I didn't hear of the group until 2018 when I read an article written by one of the members about her experience traveling to Guantanamo to observe the military commissions of five men accused of planning the attacks, which are still in pretrial hearings. And I was fascinated. First of all, I didn't know anything about the commissions. I think there's been a real effort from the beginning to kind of keep what happens there outside of the public view. But I also did not know that there were other family members of 9/11 victims who shared my political leanings and beliefs. For a long time, I felt like I did not really have a place in the 9/11 community. I was often hesitant to tell people about my identity as a 9/11, as a family member of a 9/11 victim, particularly when I learned more about the ways that the media and politicians often portray the victims, that we all want revenge for our loss. I was resistant to that victim label since I knew that did not represent my own beliefs. So doing my involvement with this organization has kind of showed me that instead of denying that part of my identity altogether, it's possible to use that identity to advance a perspective of peace.
Hmm. Where do you see the organization having its greatest impact? What is your focus?
Yeah, so I think that there's a few ways. One of the ways I've been thinking about recently is the potential to change the narrative around victimhood, and particularly the association of victimhood with revenge. So I think that this is particularly in the context of 9/11, but more broadly as well, since there's a sense in our society that you're a bad victim if you do not want revenge. But in reality, politicians have often used victims in service of broader political aims. So I think that our organization can change the narrative around what victims should or should not feel, and also hold those in authority accountable to be responsible for the power they have. And if we do not, as victims, do not fit into the views of what those in power tell us victims are supposed to believe or think, how can we hold those in authority accountable to tell them not to justify more violence through our pain?
Hmm. Has doing this work been helpful for you as a part of the healing process?
Yes, it really has. As I mentioned, I was often, growing up, I think I was afraid of being pitied or being defined by my loss. And I also, it was hard for me to accept that this very personal loss had been kind of thrown into the public eye. But all of the members of the group have experienced that, that very personal loss made public, put on display. So doing this work has kind of helped me to grapple with that identity, to realize that there's no one way to be a victim, there's no way to deal with this type of loss, and also that whether or not I like it, this is a part of my story, this is a part of who I am, and I feel like it is possible to find a space within that identity that is true to my own values, stands for what I believe in, and the people in Peaceful Tomorrows have helped me through that.
Layla, I know from my own experience that different people do their healing in different ways. The way that you have gone about showing your sorrow, how has that been in relation to how other members of your family have done that?
I think it's very different. I was so young on the day. I actually have no memories of my father. I have no memories of the day or of the time of the attacks. So I think my healing process was quite different. I really did not grapple with the effect of my father's loss and of the attacks until I was much, much older. So that has really changed my healing process and showed me that there's no one timeline of experiencing grief, of dealing with loss. It comes up in other ways. I think that for some of my family members who were there on the day itself, the day of 9/11 is perhaps more important or more meaningful in a sense in that it's very potent, the memory of that, versus for me, I often experience my loss more concretely on days like Father's Day or my father's birthday or when I'm learning more about him. So it's a very different relationship to my father and to the loss itself.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because I think among our listeners there are other people that identify with almost all of the ways in which they've tried to handle this. Layla, we see a very dark time coming for our country after the November 3rd election. What do Americans who seem ready to resort to violence against fellow citizens need to hear from someone so profoundly affected by violence like you are?
Yeah. So I think that there is a tendency that we have as human beings when we feel a deep pain or loss to want to blame someone else for that pain. It feels easier, more manageable, perhaps, like we suffered this loss, so you must be to blame. And there's this need to invoke violence as part of addressing this loss. There's the idea that violence will help to make the victims feel better. But this narrative, first of all, it doesn't work. More violence does not bring anyone back to life. And it doesn't really deal with the real consequences of the trauma and of the loss. And this narrative, I find it's also in our culture, I think we have a tendency to kind of idealize victims or put victims on this pedestal of 100% purity, and then we seek to point the blame at some identified or unidentified perpetrator. But there's no such thing as 100% purity or 100% blame. In this narrative, there's no kind of curiosity about why this happened in the first place. Like in the 9/11 context, what was our country's own role in the events that led up to the attacks? And can we think about the harm caused after the attacks as well, as a result of the war on terror? So I think that we can all learn from that in terms of having more curiosity about our own loss and the pain we feel, and more curiosity about how to deal with it how to deal with the harm caused in a more holistic way.
I've got to ask you this, the way you've answered that question. What have we still not learned about the eye for an eye approach the Bush administration launched in 2001 and 2002?
Yeah, I think that we have not learned that more violence creates more problems and just leads to more pain and does not answer the real consequences of the harm that was caused. I think we also haven't learned really how to grieve. I think that our country often responds to violence with response to real pain and loss with the need for more violence, without even stopping for a second to grieve in a real way, not grieving in a way of listing off the victims or building more public memorials, but to really understand in a holistic way the harm that was caused and the pain and the loss that so many experienced.
Layla, how can our listeners keep up with the vitally important, I would even call it prophetic work of September 11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows? And is there a way to support that work?
Yes, definitely. So you can find us on social media, Peaceful Tomorrows. You can find our website as well, doing a quick search for September 11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. And we are always looking for support. Many of the volunteers of Peaceful Tomorrows, we go to Guantanamo to observe the military commissions, are acting to challenge Islamophobia, to challenge the racist practices of the current administration and of all administrations. So there are definitely ways to support that ongoing work.
Layla Murphy lost her father in the 9/11 attacks on the Twin Towers in Lower Manhattan. She currently serves on the steering committee of Peaceful Tomorrows and is also a member of PT's Rule of Law campaign and action in support of closing the prison camp at Guantanamo. Layla, thank you so much for taking time in a very busy week to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, things will not be easy. You all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right.